Welcome to SCOTUS-CAST, Controversial Case, Uncontroversial Opinion Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 24, 2010, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Doe v. Reed. In this case, the court was asked whether compelled disclosure of signatory information on a referendum petition violated the First Amendment. In an 8-1 opinion delivered by Chief Justice Roberts, the court held that although petition signatories may have a right to non-disclosure in particular cases, they do not have a general constitutional right to non-disclosure. The court declined to answer whether, in this particular referendum on expanding the rights and responsibilities of state-registered domestic partners, including same-sex partners, the signatories' interest in avoiding persecution outweighed the state's interest in promoting transparency and assigned this task to a lower court. To discuss the case, we have the Capital University Law School Josiah H. Blackmore II and Shirley M. Naltz, Designated Professor of Law Bradley A. Smith. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now Professor Smith.
After the passage of Proposition 8 in California in 2008, which amended the state's constitution to ban same-sex marriage, the proposition's financial backers found themselves subjected to a wide range of retaliatory measures. For example, Richard Radden, who is director of the Los Angeles Film Festival, had contributed $1,500 in support of Proposition 8. He was forced to step down after opponents of the proposition threatened to boycott the festival. El Coyote, a popular restaurant in Los Angeles, faced weeks of protests and boycotts because the owner's daughter had contributed $100 to support Proposition 8. Police eventually had to be called to control the protesters, and the daughter finally left town. In another example, Scott Eckhern, a longtime artistic director of the Sacramento, California Musical Theater, was forced to resign because he had contributed $1,000 to the campaign. And the Cinemark movie theater chain suffered boycotts because its CEO had personally donated to the campaign in favor of Proposition 8. Now, the question in all this wasn't whether opponents of Proposition 8 had a right to initiate peaceful, lawful boycotts or protests, but rather whether the government should, and in fact can, compel the disclosure of other people's political activity, thus enabling such boycotts. As Candace Nichols of the Las Vegas Gay and Lesbian Community Center pointed out at that time, quote, "Years ago, we would never have been able to get a blacklist up that fast and quickly," close quote. Many websites included not only information on donors to Proposition 8, but linked that information with maps to these people's personal residences. Thus, in the wake of Proposition 8, there's been a growing amount of attention to the notion of political anonymity and to the question of when the state has a right to compel people to disclose their political activity. Doe v. Reed is the first major case to take up this proposition since the Proposition 8 controversy, the first case, of course, to reach the Supreme Court. Now, the Supreme Court has frequently ruled on the right to speak anonymously in a wide variety of contexts, but oddly enough, political speech is the one area where the court has long supported some level of mandatory disclosure. Doe v. Reed arises out of a Washington law passed a couple years back in which the legislature provided for employee benefits for same-sex couples. And after that, a controversial effort was undertaken to gather signatures to put this new law up to a popular vote, Washington being a state that allows for referenda by the voters. And the signatures were gathered. The measure to repeal the statute appeared on the November 2009 ballot, SR-71, that's Referendum 71, and voters ultimately rejected the repeal effort by a 53-47% margin. Meanwhile, various groups that opposed R-71, that is, groups that supported same-sex benefits, sought to use the state's public records law to obtain the names and addresses of those who had signed petitions to put the measure on the ballot. Their openly stated reason for doing so was to publish this information on the web and to encourage and enable opponents of R-71 to confront and harass petition signers. And various petition signatories thereafter sued the state to keep their names private, to keep those names from being released publicly. The case gets to the Supreme Court. The majority opinion was written by Chief Justice Roberts, joined by Kennedy, Ginsburg, Breyer, Alito, and Sotomayor. In fact, eight justices concurred that the state could release those names, that there was not a constitutional right of the plaintiffs to keep those names quiet, at least as a facial matter. And yet, despite the 8-1 decision on the judgment, there were no fewer than seven opinions out of the court in this case. While the court ruled in favor of the state against the plaintiffs, the decision was also in many respects quite narrow, so I don't think that this is going to be the last we're going to hear of this issue. First, the court held that the complaint should be analyzed as a First Amendment free speech issue. Now, this is important because had the court held that the issue was merely one of election administration, which is what the state argued and what Justice Scalia argues in a concurrence in the judgment, it would have decided this and future challenges to privacy on a rational basis standard. By recognizing that there were First Amendment interests at stake, the court raised the level of scrutiny to that of exacting scrutiny. Now, this is a standard that the court has used primarily in the field of election law. It's never really defined it to most observers' satisfaction, but it appears to be something less than the famous strict scrutiny applied to most Bill of Rights issues, but clearly a tougher standard for the government to meet than rational basis. So the court's finding that the First Amendment is involved in the issue is important going forward. Second, the majority made clear that it was only rejecting the plaintiff's facial challenge, and doing so because the plaintiffs had failed to demonstrate that compelled disclosure would result in harassment or create a significant burden on speech in most cases, that is, in other types of petition drives. It very specifically left open the possibility that the particular plaintiffs in Doe v. Reed might be able to show harassment and retain anonymity in the particular case, and it noted that that challenge was still going on in the district court and that this would not decide that as-applied challenge in the district court. But the problem for the plaintiffs, writes the court, is that their argument rests almost entirely on the specific harm they say would attend disclosure of the information on the R71 petition or on similarly controversial ones. But there's no reason to assume that any burdens imposed by disclosure of typical referendum petitions would be remotely like the burdens plaintiffs fear in this case. When you put that together with the court almost inviting that as-applied challenge to go forward, it suggests that there's quite a bit of sympathy on the court to the plaintiffs in this particular case. Additionally, in defending the public disclosure of names, the state invoked two interests. First was protecting public integrity of the system by making sure that signatories were not fraudulent or that signatures were not ineligible to sign. Second, it alleged an informational interest to the public simply in knowing who supported a measure. Now, the court only adopted the first of these rationales. It did not reject the second. It simply didn't rule on it. But that is also important because it does mean, at least going forward, that the state is not in a position, or other states would not be in a position, to rely solely on this informational interest, this idea of the public's right to know. Rather, at this point, this case is only precedent for the idea that a realistic anti-fraud measure would be constitutional. And here the idea is that requiring disclosure of the signatures on the petition allows people to police those and make sure that the petition in fact gathered the adequate number of signatures. It sort of provides the ability for citizens to act as private attorney generals almost to help the state in verifying signatures. Now, as I mentioned, despite the 8-1 ruling on the judgment, the court managed to come up with seven opinions. Justice Breyer wrote a one-page concurrent to emphasize that he pretty much sees everything as a balancing test, and he wouldn't want anybody to think that there are any bright rules in constitutional law. Justice Alito writes a more meaningful concurrence in which he notes that as-applied challenges must be decided quickly and under a relatively low evidentiary threshold if they are to have any value. He goes on to suggest that the evidence in this case, primarily looking at the aftermath of Proposition 8 in California, probably means that plaintiffs would meet the burden necessary to get an as-applied exception. And this is important, not only because it reflects his views, but he's been a bellwether here before. A few years ago in Wisconsin Right to Life versus FEC, this was a case that first established a broad standard for as-applied exemptions to provisions of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito noted that if such as-applied exceptions proved impractical, facial relief might become proper. And that facial relief came just 3 years later in Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, a controversial case decided earlier this term, which struck down facially some of these provisions of the McCain-Feingold law. Meanwhile, Justice Sotomayor, joined by Justice Stevens and Ginsburg, and Justice Stevens, joined by Justice Breyer, each write at some length to discuss what they see as the state's interest versus the interest of the signatories of the plaintiffs. And both seem to indicate that they think this is a pretty easy case. Both seem to also take on Alito's opinion and argue that, in fact, as applied challenges should face a very heavy burden. Stevens, in particular, seems to think it's a pretty easy case, but frankly, as he joins Sotomayor's opinion, it's hardly clear to me why he felt a need to write something at all. He does seem to want to disavow his 1995 opinion in McIntyre versus Ohio Elections Commission, in which he wrote for the majority protecting anonymous political speech. He writes that that decision, contrary to what pretty much everybody has believed for 15 years, was not about the right to anonymous speech. And he also seems to want to defend his 2008 decision in Crawford versus Marion County Board of Elections, in which he held that voter ID laws were justified by the state's concern for fraud. And that's a decision for which he has taken quite a bit of heat from the political left. Importantly, he goes out of his way to disagree with Alito and suggest again that this case would be very unlikely to succeed in an as-applied challenge. Also important is the concurrence in the judgment by Justice Scalia. His opinion is extremely hostile to the plaintiff's claim. Scalia argues that the signatories are engaged in a legislative act, that they're signing a petition has legal consequences, and thus he argues that there is no First Amendment protection at all for the plaintiffs. In fact, he somewhat gratuitously takes on the question of secret voting, arguing that there's no right to vote in secret. Now, this is an interesting topic of debate these days among election law specialists, but it hardly was one necessary to decide this particular case. He again excoriates the McIntyre decision from which he dissented. That was, again, the decision that struck down an Ohio law requiring disclaimers on all political leaflets. And he suggests that disclosure is vital to encourage what he calls, quote, civic courage. And he argues that without this kind of civic courage, quote, democracy is doomed. Now, Scalia's opinion is important. It did not draw support from elsewhere on the court. But as long as Scalia remains this hostile to anonymous speech, it may be very tough for similar plaintiffs in any kind of case to cobble together a majority to protect political anonymity. If we assume, as seems to be the case, that the court's liberals will uphold any statute that is labeled in any way campaign finance reform, and Scalia joins them on any kind of disclosure issue, it's going to give Congress and state legislatures quite a broad bit of leeway to impose disclosure requirements. And of course, in the wake of Citizens United, Congress has moved very aggressively to impose extensive disclosure requirements on campaign spenders through the act called the Disclose Act, which passed the House of Representatives in June of 2010. And this recording is pending before the U.S. Senate. Finally, while Justices Thomas and Scalia typically vote together more than any two justices, they continue to disagree about disclosure. Thomas, who was in the majority in the McIntyre case, is the lone dissenter here. He sees the burden on speech as severe and argues that the state interest in preventing fraud can be satisfied by less restrictive means. There has been a tendency to see this case in the press as one of gay rights advocates against traditional marriage advocates, and this has also been the approach of most gay rights advocates. But I think that that is extremely short-sighted. For example, in early May, just a few weeks before this decision came down, a federally funded multi-jurisdictional anti-drug task force in Tacoma, Washington, seized dozens of petitions that would put on the Washington ballot a referendum to legalize marijuana. Many of the same left-wing blogs that have been clamoring for the release of R71 petition signers are screaming at the top of their lungs that this act of seizing petitions for legalizing marijuana by law enforcement is a gross violation of the First Amendment intended solely to intimidate people out of signing these types of petitions. Now, while Justice Scalia may insist that we all need to toughen up a bit, I suspect that knowledgeable people in Washington State and elsewhere will be just a bit less likely to sign petitions in the future. The incentives to participate in politics are really very few. It's all but guaranteed that never in your life is your signature going to make the difference between a ballot initiative getting on the ballot or not. Never in your life will your single vote mean the difference between your favorite candidate winning or losing. Never will your financial contribution put your candidate over the hump, and never will your few hours of volunteer time make or break your candidate in the race. In other words, all of the incentives are for people not to be involved in public life, not to take the time, but rather to free ride on the efforts of others. Telling them that they simply need to get tougher and be willing to risk a little more public harassment may not be the best way to go, but that's where, at least for the moment, Dovi Reed leaves us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.